Thousands assemble in Glasgow by jet to discuss how urgent climate action is. Climate elites fail to demonstrate a track record of accomplishment themselves while promising major global change. And they promise military-style coercion to ensure climate obedience. Hi, I'm Michael Thiessen with Tim Tyso, and this is Liberty Dispatch.
Ladies and gentlemen, we may be approaching a fateful hour.
Bonhoeffer spoke by radio to a national audience. He delivered one of the first public criticisms of the new chancellor.
Never give in. Never, never, never. In nothing, great or small, large or petty, never give in except to convictions of honor and good sense.
Welcome to Liberty Dispatch, broadcasting across enemy lines into the Canadian culture war. Tomorrow, special announcement, Tuesday the 30th, we will be bringing you a special legal update with lawyer James Kitchen. Mike Thiessen sits down with lawyer James Kitchen and Will Tightgrabber to hear the story of a dentistry student in Alberta whose graduation plans are at risk, and we need your help to fill the Liberty Defense Fund as soon as possible to help this student. And as our first year comes to an end, we are in critical need. So many people need justice to be done, and so we have committed to three legal cases. Dr. Curtis Wall in British Columbia, Will Tightgrabber in Alberta, and university students in Ontario. We need to raise $180,000 to uphold these commitments, and we don't want to leave anybody behind. We need your help to fill the Liberty Defense Fund by the end of Giving Tuesday, so please visit our donate tab at libertycoalitioncanada.com and please help us meet those financial commitments for our legal defense fund.
Yeah, if give you are today. Tuning in on,
give yeah, today. Get on it. That's right. And thanks for joining us on the show today. And so this is part two of our climate special that we promised you. And it's been a little while getting ready for this one. We missed last week. Mike and I were away.
Tim, thanks for all of the work that you're doing and all of the research that you're pouring into this. I want to begin our discussion today with just reviewing last week. So last week, as we discussed climate, the climate propaganda, we went at the underlying assumptions. And here they are again for everybody to hear. Number one, that climate weather patterns are changing in a manner that is intolerably hostile towards humanity. So we talked about last week just examples of how we're talking about a threat level, extinction threat level threat. That is an assumption that drives these discussions. Then number two, that humanity is responsible for these changes and therefore culpable or capable for reversing them. So there, we talked about that whole assumption that humans can control the environment so finely. In fact, just in reading this week, you know, there is this desire for us to control the climate within 1.5 degrees. That was all a part of the Glasgow meetings, which is, you know, keeping 1.5C alive. So the assumption is that we humans can control the environment, the weather of the of our entire
that we can specifically planet. Limit. We can limit global temperature rise to 1.5 degrees. I mean, talk about precise. Can you even keep your stove to within a half a degree? You know, with a dial on it.
That's right. And so the last one, Tim, is that the ideal condition of the Earth is to be undisturbed. That means free from impact of human progress. And this is just, this is one of those areas where we talked about value, we talked about guilt, we talked about the redefinition of virtue, all of these different areas with regarding what we do here on Earth. It seems that humans are damned to do nothing. And so those are the assumptions. And then Tim, now you've kind of laid out some things you wanted to talk about today. So what are we talking about today?
Yeah, and this was difficult just for you and I to sort through because there's so much said and commitments made. But what we really, I think, want to reduce this to, and our first point is that the discussion is mediated, which means it's led by and presented by what we would call hypocrites who don't have a track record of living green themselves and who they liken their meetings to accomplishments. And so this is from the description of the event themselves. We have world leaders arrived in Scotland alongside tens of thousands of negotiators, government representatives, businesses, and civil society groups for 14 days of talks. Tens of thousands of mediators and negotiators and policymakers and so forth. And they all arrived by private jet or corporate jet in to get there to discuss how urgent climate action is. And one of those things is obviously the reduction of fossil fuels. Scotland's first minister, Nicola Sturgeon, said that she understood that the air travel involved may send a mixed message. We call that hypocrisy, but carry on. She agreed that more progress is made when leaders meet in person. And so the idea here is that the work that we're doing is so critical, we can't afford to abide by our own restrictions, by our own advice, by our own mandates. We can't afford not to live with fossil fuels because the event is so critical. And so there's this hypocritical idea that, well, yeah, these rules are important in general, but because what we're doing is so important and we're actually going to be the ones fixing the problem, we need fossil fuels to do it. Which, I mean, do they imagine that this is the last problem that'll ever need to be solved with fossil fuels?
Well, I think this first point that we want to highlight lends itself to the hypocrisy of the entire discussion. And that is simply that in talking about reducing all of the carbon emissions, the reality of it is that people heat their homes for their own good and for the health of their families. People travel the globe because in-person meetings are beneficial in order to get stuff done. Although I would say just
we said that
in this
show before,
in this case, just so anyone's clear, tens of thousands of negotiators simply means nothing got done. You're talking about tens of thousands of people eating at buffets and enjoying lunches together. If anybody has ever negotiated a deal, you know that the smaller number of negotiators you have in a room, the better. So there's just when they say tens of thousands of negotiators, all they meant was tens of thousands of people just enjoying taxpayers' money from somewhere to have a lavish event that was probably pre-decided by about five people.
Too many spoons in the sauce, I think they say, about that sort of negotiating environment, right?
But this entire situation is hypocritical because and sends mixed messages because the entire agenda is full of mixed messages. Unless people are willing, unless first world countries are willing and first world leaders are willing to walk away from fossil fuels themselves, they shouldn't call anyone else to do so.
That's exactly the point, is that this is a problem that they see requiring fossil fuels. It would take too long to get there by, remember when Greta Thunberg made a trip across the Atlantic in a fiberglass boat, but all the media that went there to cover her arrival flew by jet? I mean, this is the kind of thing that it's like, it's not practical to live by wind and solar power. It just isn't. They're great supplemental, but so that what they're admitting is that there are problems that require the speed and convenience and ease of fossil fuels. And this is one of those problems, but only we're allowed to make that decision. If you have a problem that requires fossil fuels, you need to find an alternative.
And we would like to tax you on your decision so that we can then refund our own initiatives at the same
right.
time.
Right. And in 5 more years, you're going to have more, and we're going to talk about this in the next point. In 5 more years, you're going to see another summit, and the language is going to be that much more urgent.
Yeah. Mike, so the second part of the discussion then is that these discussions are mediated by individuals who don't have a track record to solve small problems, even in their own country. I don't know why the word small was so hard for me to say there. Schmall. You know, there's a scriptural principle that he who is faithful with little will be faithful with much. And the opposite is he who is not faithful with little shouldn't be faithful, given responsibility for much.
Yeah.
So let's talk about this here, Tim, because basically you're laying out the fact that each of these talks continues to be more urgent, which would mean that they're not having effect.
That's sort of the idea here. And I got a couple quotes from Boris Johnson I want to share, and not because I think he's uniquely hypocritical or evil, but he was the host. He was the host nation, and so his remarks carry a certain amount of weight. But what I would ask, and I remember the last big one of these they had was Paris, 2015. It was right after Justin Trudeau was elected. And I remember, you know, he filled a plane with his delegates, and they went over. And you couldn't help but see the air of glee and enjoyment. Here we go to solve somebody else's problem at a global level on somebody else's dime. And what I love that I've been listening to Jordan Peterson lately, and one of the concepts that he's really been pounding was to say, if you can't show me that you can fix something small or manageable. See, I got the word small out there, no problem, Mike. Manageable. If you can't fix something that is within your realm, how are you going to come to me and say, I'm going to fix the global temperature rise to within 1.5 degrees? And just a quick search this morning, Mike, showed that Canada has over 600 boil watery advisories. Now, I'm not just picking a trendy topic to say, look, you know, Trudeau, and kind of stick it to him, but to say, the resources that we're pouring into managing the globe's temperature, in 30 years, this is the limit scope of this 1.5 to stay alive. It's about 2050, I think, 30 years from now. 1.5 degrees of warming makes little difference to a mother who's on a boil watery advisor today, whose children can't consume safe water and cooking. I mean, just the basic idea of making food for your family and making sure that that water is sanitary first. This is an environmental issue that Canadians face, and some of the most vulnerable Canadians and low-income Canadians. And to say, you know, I'm going to go fix global climate, and Trudeau, in his remarks, he said that they were going to cap oil production, which is Canada's one of our biggest resources, and affects tens of thousands of jobs and economic stability all across this nation. And to say this is what we're going to do without demonstrating that you can do something on a lower level is extraordinarily hypocritical. And there's no proof. There's no assurance that capping oil production is actually going to achieve any of these things. And that speaks to last week's episode. We talked about assumptions that the things they're saying they're going to do are going to accomplish what they say they're going to do. And so we're lacking any form of proof, any form of, hey, we've done this, we can fix problems and we can really help people. We need a little bit of money to do it, and this is a project complete. We don't have any of that at the environmental level, and that's a huge concern.
I think actually it's a tool of distraction, right? So as long as we can keep pointing out to the big boogeyman way out there, very far away, that we cannot solve, it brings the urgent eyes away from those things that we can solve. And that's I want to just draw a little bit of clarity on something you said there, Tim. You said that the boil water advisories are an environmental issue. You know, often, right, we trade this mythological environmental issue or certainly a really undefinable, right? You know, something that's very far away, something that is hard to grasp, for something that's a real environmental issue, meaning that it, like, there's actual water that's not clean that can be cleansed through a process and solved. So it's one environmental issue, capital E, real, there, able to be solved, for another environmental issue, full of theory, full of conjecture, Like,
it's an abstraction rather than a concrete example.
And
it's
so,
chasing a ghost.
Right, exactly. So I think that's why we continue to try to bring this up, because, you know, let's solve our simple problems rather than just pointing the finger out there and going, no, we got to get out there. We don't talk to me about this issue right around the corner. Right.
And I just want to share what Boris Johnson said, because again, this idea that they're achieving so much by going to these meetings, which, as you said, are very lavish. They're fun. Hotels are paid for. You know, Boris Johnson said, if this was a football match, the score would be 5-1 down in the match between humanity and climate change. In other words, we are losing really badly. And if you know, European football, if you're down 5-1, the game's over. You know, most goals are a one game margin. He said, I think that what you can say today after 2 days with around 120 world leaders is that we've pulled back a goal or perhaps even two, and we could take this down to extra time because there's no doubt that progress has been made. So again, it's progress in the abstraction. It's progress in the theoretical. There was nothing physically accomplished. There is no project complete. But because there's this sense of grandeur and competency, just meeting for 2 days, they say they've pulled a goal or two back from the environment in the fight to stay alive. I mean, not only is it ridiculous hyperbole, but it shows the extent to which they think they're making progress simply by talking, as you said, Mike, in the abstract.
Yeah, it's really interesting here. Of course, a situation that's solved in 90 minutes, talking about pulling back two goals in 2 days. And again, all in the context of thousands and thousands of delegates sitting around talking. This is really where we need to get back to having our governments focus on national issues, mm-hmm. on national attainable goals that mm-hmm. that better the lives of Canadians, and yeah, rather today. Than constantly getting out there and having these big global statements. That's like you just said, Tim, that statement on itself, just there's no comparison there. There was nothing practically done. All they did was uphold something that they had set out to achieve back in Paris. They kept it alive.
They upheld their assumptions is what they did. They reaffirmed their assumptions. Let's go to point three, because if you think that was good from Johnson, we got some good stuff coming ahead here.
Right. So the last thing we want to talk about here, and this has to do a lot in my mind, it has to do a lot with money, is that the climate discussion is predominantly presented and mediated by these individuals who use unquantifiable rhetoric, like we just said, and then that will eventually lead to coercion in order to curtail dissidents. So I want to talk just a little bit about something that came out of the GOP 26, and that was this. It was a call for developed countries or developed country parties to at least double their collective provision of climate finance for adaptation to developing country parties. I don't know why you can't just call them countries, why you have to call them country parties, from 2019 levels by 2025. So what you have is a notable call for developed countries to double their collective provision for climate finance up to $100 billion a year in climate finance towards developing countries. And this goal is going to have to be eventually achieved by coercion, because how much money do Canadians have to spend on experimental technology for other nations that are going to spend that money at their discretion?
Yeah, that's right. And this is, it's a funneling of, I mean, and we know that we need capital to live. You know, you need economic progress and production in order to live. And so when you're talking about funneling tens of billions of dollars out of the economy to work on and produce untested and non-concrete technology, it's harmful. And of course, whenever money's involved and the state's involved, coercion is involved. We've talked about that on this show many times, where the state has a tool, and it's the sword to enforce these ideals. And this is a little bit different than just a national authority, because this is these are global movements. These are governments cooperating across national sovereignty, as well as with, and this is what's really eerie, is global private enterprises and companies like the World Economic Forum, led by Klaus Schwab, highly influential private billionaires dictating the lives of people around them. But they don't do it just like that. They don't just come across as a villain. And I want to use Lord of the Rings here as an analogy. Because what I see, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but when I see these leaders stand up, they see themselves in a way like a tragic hero. Like the unassuming Frodo who came upon the ring from his uncle Bilbo. And this ring was so powerful and so destructive, it had to be carried to back to the fires of Mount Doom to be destroyed so that humanity could be saved. And it's not a burden that he carries lightly. We know, you look at Frodo, and it was tremendously taxing. It was not a journey of, you know, pure joy. And these elites, despite the fact that they're gaining from this, you know, Al Gore's net worth went from $2 million to $300 million in a little over a decade because of his environmental work. Despite the fact that they're profiteering from all this, that's not what they present. They say, look, this is the eyes of the world are watching us. The eyes of history are on us, Joe Biden said, who was also filmed sleeping through many of the... Actually, the clip of him sleeping was amazing, because the background vocals, there's somebody saying, this is one of the most important meetings in the history of mankind. And Joe Biden's asleep saying, you know, the eyes of history are upon us. Boris Johnson also said, the clock on the doomsday device is still ticking. But we've got a bomb disposal team who is on site, and they're starting to snip the wires. I hope some of the right ones. My message to them is very simple. The leaders of the world may have left or are leaving COP now, but the eyes of the world are upon you. The eyes of the British government and all the other governments that care about this. We have your numbers. So there's this ominous threat level where it says that, you know, that there is no room for error here. And we, you know, it has come upon our time to take up this mantle and to do the hard work. And they're taking on this, not only this sort of self-pity, like, you know, look how hard we're working, but there's an inflection of coercion, and there's an inflection of threat upon those who might not take this as seriously as they need to. And it seems like the British imperial mindset is still alive and well. Prince Charles, who is slated to become king in the not-so-distant future, long may the Queen reign, he said that efforts cannot be a series of independent initiatives running parallel. In other words, private and individual efforts cannot be tolerated. He said, we need... I'm just going to find this quote here. He said, we need a vast military-style campaign to marshal the strength of the global private sector. I mean, and this is a military man. Prince Charles did serve in the military. He understands the language of marshaling a military campaign. And he's not talking about being persuasive and compelling. He's talking about using the power of the state and of their collective authority to enforce measures that are, again, unproven, untested, theoretical. And this is a dangerous type of rhetoric coming from a very charming sounding voice. You know, it's so easy to be lulled to sleep by a lovely British voice. And yet it's scary.
And of course, this is connected to the collection of all of the money that is needed in order to fund these projects, or in order to redistribute wealth towards the developing world. Now, the irony is that if, you know, I've lived in Africa, and a few of the things that would be just amazing in Africa would be natural gas in people's homes, would be electricity servicing being dependable, would be many of the modern conveniences that we have because of the burning of fossil fuels. The reality is that these statements, though, this is where they have to go. When you go from a statement of like you know, we've got a bomb that's about to be exploding and we've got the team on site, and you look and you go, which team? And it's like, oh, there's like 7,000 people over at the buffet there. It's that team. That's the bomb disposal site. That's the bomb disposal team. You go, oh, great. The guys at the buffet, they've got us. And then you go, but wait, that doesn't mean anything. But we have to spend $100 billion. So of course this lends itself to the fact that you have the prince coming out and saying, you know, we are going to need to pull people into compliance here. And we have seen this, of course, in the last year in a way that in my lifetime, we would never have imagined people would put up with. But really, yeah. coming out of this conference, what we're seeing is, again, the pivoting from the coercion that we've experienced during the pandemic to further coercion towards now climate change.
And Mike, let's not forget that this is not a shot in the dark comparison that you've just made. This was a campaign promise of Justin Trudeau that we are going to learn from the tools that we used in the pandemic to fight climate change. There's no mistaking that the coercion that we've experienced under the pandemic management is only a foretaste and a flavor of what is to come under climate change. And I want to quote Paul Ehrlich, who we quoted from last week. He's a professor in the 1960s in California, whose predictions were all wildly wrong about nuclear war and famine and food shortage. We're talking about coercion. And he said, and one of his great concerns was population control. He said, birth control should be accomplished involuntarily, putting sterilizing agents into drinking water and food supply. This was an academic in the 1960s speaking on behalf of the earth, on behalf of the environment. This is how we're going to manage it. And you may not hear that kind of Bond villain-esque evil from the COP, you know, Prince Charles. But the same spirit of coercion, the same spirit of control and authoritarianism exists in the movement and always has. It just comes out in different ways and maybe more polite and managed on one side than the other. But it's the same spirit and the same level and willingness to control other people, things that God has ordained and God has bestowed on people, like producing a family, things that only God has done. You know, the spirit of coercion says, we'll take it away because we have an agenda. And this agenda is bigger than you and it's bigger than me. And that's what's been said all through COVID, right? This is bigger than you. It's bigger than me. And when you do that, you marshal the obedience. You marshal accommodation. You marshal an obedience and compliance. That's the word. Thank you. You marshal compliance when you build an issue that is so big and so vast that the cost to achieve it is made worth it.
So I just want to summarize here what we've gone over. Show one was the underlining assumptions, and those underlining assumptions are so grand, so full of load on placing responsibility on mankind, to the point where those assumptions want to see such a limited footprint of mankind on the earth. And then today we've started to go over just some of the absurdity of the leaders themselves. And folks, if you're sitting back there and you're going, you know, why would you be attacking individuals who are just trying to defend the planet or just trying to save humanity? The reason that we're taking our time to, you know, attack the idea that these individuals really want a green world while thousands of them come together in one meeting place, and that these people really, really want to be able to control the global climate while they can't solve simple problems. Why are we criticizing people who might want to come out and say, hey, yeah, let's use military force in order to achieve these goals? It's because this is how the enemy far away becomes the tyrant nearby. This is how you have coercion come all the way down the line, where as long as politicians will continue to toe these grand narratives, they'll never stand up for your local ability to burn firewood.
Right.
Like they're going to give in to the global narrative the more that narrative goes unchecked. And so particularly for those who are going to fly halfway across the world to talk about the burning of fossil fuels being so terrible, if you're serious, then you don't go to those things. And if you're not serious, then we have to stop playing this game, because all it does is lead into tyrants far, far away, reaching deep down into our own personal lives here today. Which, by the way, you know, Tim, you kind of meshed two stories together here at the very end when we're talking about Paul Hrelik. You know, the reality of it is that people have attempted to use eugenics in the past. People have attempted to control the population in the past. And so far, we thank God that they've been defeated. These social experiments have been defeated. But we right. see that we're on the edge of another social experiment.
Yep.
And that's yep. what and we're concerned about here. So, yep. Tim, why don't I give you the last word of the show?
Yep. And, you know, Mike, there's a lot of nuttery going around in the days that we live on both sides. And we just want to acknowledge that. These are complicated issues, but if you stop and take a look and pull apart these ideas and analyze them and begin to think, and this is, I think, where we want to end the show today, is talking to people who disagree with you on this. Ask them questions. Question them the way that we've just questioned these topics, the way that we analyze them. Just ask questions to get at the assumptions and to get at sort of the concrete realities behind them. And you may find that people are open to being persuaded, but don't be dismayed that this is a very large movement that's very well funded. And so we need to do our best to fund the truth as well. And so there's my transition to once again remind you that Giving Tuesday is coming. Please fill our legal defense fund, our Liberty Legal Defense Fund. And don't forget to donate to Liberty Coalition Canada at the donate tab. Thanks for joining us today on Liberty Dispatch. Join us next week where we tackle the culture war through the headlines.
Thanks, everybody. Godspeed.
Thanks for tuning in to Liberty Dispatch, a united front to restore liberty and justice in Canada. Please subscribe to our podcast and Rumble channel, as well as visit our website at www.libertycoalitioncanada.com.